Okay. We're going to pick up on page 59. So far, St. Francis has talked about, you know, the commandments of God, the counsels of God, and the inspirations of God, and that's what he's talking about right now. Making decisions that are based on the will of God and the inspirations that he gives us when we are looking to make a decision. It's very similar to what St. Ignatius Loyola did when he established his spiritual exercises. When he formed the Jesuit order, he went through this the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. And it was a 30-day process. And each day there's a scripture reading, and then there are questions. And he said you should never do the spiritual exercises unless there's a question that's important to you that you have to get an answer to. And so this is a 30-day period where you're trying to discern the will of God to answer an important question. For him, the question was, do I start the Jesuit order? Well, I guess it's a society, not an order. The last order was the Franciscans. But his is a society called the Society of Jesus, SJs. And but he said there are other important questions you might have in your life, you know. Do I marry this person or not? Do I go to this college or not? Those kinds of things that are important to your life and would affect the future of your life. And so he said you go through this 30-day period of exercises, and then you ask God for his inspiration and guidance in coming up with the right decision at the end of that time period. Not everybody's got 30 days to devote to this. When I was educated by the Jesuits, every year we'd go through an Ignatian retreat, but sometimes it was only a weekend, not a full 30 days. And so sometimes you have to just kind of, you know, do what you can do at the time. And so what Francis is talking here is about just people on their own, personally, trying to make a decision and then seeking God's inspiration for making the right decision. And then sometimes, just out of the blue, he'll give you this inspiration. You'll be sitting there eating soup or something, and all of a sudden, this inspiration will come and say, well, where'd that come from? And so then you have to decide, well, is this something from God or not? And he talks about, you know, what you should experience or not experience, depending on whether it's coming from God or from the devil. This is one of the best marks of... We covered this, I think, this paragraph last time. One of the best marks of the goodness of all inspirations, and especially the extraordinary, is peace and tranquility of heart in those who receive them, since the Holy Spirit is indeed violent, but with a violence that is gentle, mild, and peaceful. See, it comes like a violent wind and like thunder from heaven, but he does not overthrow them, nor does he trouble them. What he's saying here is that when he comes with an inspiration, you're going to know it. It's not going to be something so subtle that you don't see it. But it's not going to be something that's going to trouble you. Peace and tranquility are the two primary things you look for when you're getting an inspiration like this. Anxiety, if you feel anxiety about it, is probably not from God. And that's the main point he's making there. That one of the greatest tools that Satan uses is giving us anxiety in our decisions. And when we have anxiety about it, you know, if we want to do something good and we'll get all this anxiety about it, well, that's coming from Satan because he doesn't want you to do the good thing. But if you feel very peaceful and tranquil about the decision you're coming to, chances are it's God's inspiration. So that's one of the main things you kind of try to sense when you're trying to decide what to do. Do you feel good about this decision? Does it make you feel calm and peaceful? Or do you have a lot of anxiety about it? And he talks about the Holy Spirit, the spouse of our souls. He says his inspiration in no way disturbs or troubles her, the soul, but draws her so gently that he causes her soul to melt with delight and as it were to flow into him. So that's another way to talk about that same thing, about feeling peace and tranquility about the decision process. And then he goes on and talks about, he's got some quotes from different people in scripture, the canticles and that sort of thing. And he says, God's servants who have had the highest and most exalted inspirations have been the gentlest and most peaceful men in all the world. That's the top of page 60. Then he gives some examples there, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And gentle and peaceful. Think about Abraham. Now he's sitting there, he's got all these flocks, he's a very wealthy man, he's got all these possessions and stuff, but he doesn't really own land. His wealth is in his cattle and those kinds of things. And so God comes to him and says, hey, knock, knock, you know, hello, who's there? I'm God, and I'm going to be your God, and I'm going to send you someplace. I'm going to send you off to this other place where different from where you are right now. And I'm going to give you this land as your inheritance for forever. And Abraham says, okay, let's do it. He just drops everything and says, okay, let's go have some fun, you know. And he goes off, and then he talks to his nephew Lot. Now, if you look, read the story, at first Lot is referred to as his brother. But that's because of the language. You know, they are his brother and sister. Later on, it says that Lot is the son of his brother, so it means he's a nephew. But they had no word for nephew or niece or that kind of thing in the language. So everybody was brother and sister. But, you know, he goes off, and so he and Lot divide up their stuff, and he says, well, where do you want to go? And Lot goes off, and then he goes off and does whatever God tells him to do. And so he's always responding peacefully to the commands of God. And so God really blessed him greatly. And then he finally, when he has a child, God said, I'm going to make you a great nation. You have descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky. And then he says, I want you to kill your only son. And we know that story. You know, so Isaac goes up the hill. They say it's probably the same hill that Christ climbed when he was crucified. And he was carrying the wood of his execution on his back. And all the while, Abraham is this real peaceful person because he still believed what God told him, that his descendants would be numerous as the stars in the sky. He's only got this one kid. That because he said, my covenant will be with Isaac, not with Ishmael. And so he just walks up there trusting. And Isaac says, where's the sacrifice? He said, God will provide. And he says his trust is just so peaceful because he trusted in God's commands and inspirations. And then we all know what happened, of course. But it's just an example, he and Isaac and Jacob and Moses, they all were very trusting in what God told them. So when God told Moses to do something, he did it. He didn't say, well, now, what are you asking me to do that for? He didn't argue with him. You know how kids are. You tell the kids to do something, and they'll sit there and argue with you. Why do you want me to do this? Why do you want me to do that? And they go through, and so you're always fighting with your kids to get them to do what you want to do. But these people never did. God said, do this, and they did it. It's like the Blessed Mother, Said, how are you going to do this? And then be it done to me according to your will. So that's a kind of a common experience you see when people are really following the inspirations of God, because everything's very tranquil, peaceful in their hearts. And then he says, on the contrary, the evil spirit is turbulent, bitter, and restless. Those who follow his hellish suggestions in the belief that they are heavenly inspirations can usually be recognized because they are unsettled, headstrong, haughty, and ready to undertake or meddle in affairs. Under the pretext of zeal, they subvert everything, criticize everyone, rebuke everyone, and find fault with everything. They are men without self-control and without consideration, who put up with nothing. In the name of zeal for God's honor, they indulge in the passions of self-love. Say, I'm right, you're wrong, you got to do what I say. So that's a pretty good list of things to watch out for when you feel like you're being inspired to do something. Do you feel those kinds of things? If so, then they're probably not coming from God. And then next section is titled, When Following Inspirations, Always Obey the Authority of the Church. God gave us a church. He gave the church the authority to teach. And so we follow the teachings of the church. When you never put embark on a path that's going to put you in a contrary position with the teachings of the church. And that's what really worries me right now about what's going on in Germany. Mm-hmm. Because they're putting in place a path on a synod of synodality that's going to put them in schism. Because they're looking at the doctrines of the church and say, well, it's time to change the doctrines. Why would God ever change his doctrine? Yeah. You know, God doesn't change. He's eternal. God does not change. And he doesn't change his mind either. You know? So he gave us the doctrines, and he gave them to us for a reason, for our spiritual good. And when you start messing with that, you're messing with God. And that's not going to go well in the long run. Either they're going to back off from that, or they're going to end up being in schism. And I really feel for the poor Catholics in Germany who want to be good Catholics. Mm-hmm. There are several of them, and several of the bishops and all. It's going to cause a real problem. I don't know what they're going to do, because they'll end up with two different churches in Germany. Unless they leave Germany.
And the book said we already have a good evangelical Lutheran church.
Yeah.
Which, he's kind of late because he was so tolerant of all this.
But. Right. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see how it all works out. But God's in charge, right? It's Jesus' church. He said, it's my church. And so.
So maybe God wants to get rid of that section. Let him go.
I don't know. We don't know. Anyway. You know, it's his mystical body, it's his church, so he's in control. You know, whatever he wills is going to happen. So he says, always obey the authority of the church. He says, most holy humility is inseparably joined to peace and joy of heart. So he's tying the virtue of humility, which is called the Queen of Virtues, he's connecting that with the idea of peace and tranquility of heart when you're receiving inspirations from God. He said, I do not give the name of humility to the ceremonious mixture of words, gestures, kissings of earth, signs of reverence, and bows, if these are made, as often happens, without any inward sense of one's own abjection and lack of true esteem for our neighbor. All that is merely the vain amusement of feeble minds. It must be called phantom humility rather than humility itself. So people can put on an air of humility without really being humble of heart. He said, I speak here of noble, genuine, fruitful, solid humility, which makes us easy to correct, submissive, and prompt to obey. And so if you're coming up with some idea that's contrary to church doctrine, and your priest or your bishop tells you that, oh, no, that's not right because it's contrary to doctrine, you're easy to correct. You say, oh, okay, I'll correct what I'm doing. You don't sit there and fight with your priest and bishop over it. You know, I'm right, you're wrong. You know, you don't do that kind of stuff. And then he talks about some examples of different people that one guy ended up living on top of this pillar. He had this pillar. He climbed to the top. He just sat up there.
You mean recently?
No. This is old. This is something that happened before Francis. Okay. And so he was. He talks about the problem he had with obedience and all that kind of stuff. And And he ended up on a 10-foot pillar, then a 20-foot pillar, then a 30-foot pillar, then a 50-foot pillar. And he's just sitting up there all day long, you know. It's just kind of a weird example. And so then you go over to page 63, at the top of 63. It says, when God sends his inspirations into a man's heart, the first one he gives is that of obedience. And, of course, we just talked about Abraham, and he's a perfect example of that. You know, God said, do this, and Abraham said, okay, I'm off to do it. You know, he didn't sit there and, you know, fight about it and commiserate or anything else. He just said, okay, you're God, I'm Abraham, and you're going to be my God, and I'm going to do what you said. But the idea of, there's a tie-in between humility and obedience. You're not going to be obedient to God's inspirations if you're not humble. Because if you're not humble, you always think you know best. And that's just how it works. So there's the idea of obedience and humility are always tied together there. And then he talks about St. Paul and his conversion process, and when he went to Ananias and learned from him initially what he was supposed to do. Because Jesus said, go into town and Ananias will tell you what to do. So Ananias was the bishop of Damascus. And so he taught, you know, Paul first. Ananias was a very celebrated man and bishop of Damascus, a man who says that he is inspired and then refuses to obey his superiors and follow their advice is really an imposter. And so Paul followed the advice of Ananias, as he should, because Ananias was the bishop there. And another example of that is Padre Pio, which is a man who says that he is inspired and then refuses to obey his superiors, follow their advice as an imposter. Padre Pio was not an imposter, as we all know. And, you know, he was probably one of the greatest confessors the church has ever had, and yet his bishop said you can't hear confessions for 3 years because I think you don't know enough about moral theology. He could read souls. You know? But he didn't argue with him. Out of obedience and humility, he did exactly what his bishop said. Then he says, all prophets and preachers inspired by God have always loved the church, always adhered to her doctrine. And of course, that's what's going on in Germany right now, trying to change the doctrine. And always had her approval. So nobody does things contrary to the teachings of the church and the approval of the church. If you want to go do something, a bishop says, no, you can't do that. You don't sit there and fight with him. You listen to what your bishop says. Since they have never proclaimed anything as forcefully as this truth, that the lips of the priest shall keep knowledge, and that they must seek the law at his mouth. And then he talks about extraordinary missions as opposed to ordinary missions. And he said, hence, extraordinary missions are diabolical illusions and not heavenly inspirations if they are not recognized and approved by your pastor on the ordinary mission. So you might feel called to do something really extraordinary, but you go to the church first and talk about it. And then you get your pastor's permission to do it. Because it might be something that's ordinary that you want to take to some extraordinary level. And that's maybe not what should happen. And so you always want to, you know, always talk about it with your pastor before you're going to take on some really extraordinary thing that goes way beyond the ordinary. Says St. Francis and St. Dominic and the other fathers of religious orders turn to the service of souls by an extraordinary inspiration, but they submit it all more humbly and heartily to the sacred hierarchy of the church. Like none of them started the orders they did without permission of the Pope. St. Francis went to the Pope and said, can I form the Franciscan order? He got permission first before he did it. And St. Ignatius, too, when he when he went, he wasn't able to form another order like the Dominicans and Franciscans, because they said, we don't have any more orders. But he formed a society, the Society of Jesus. And he got the Pope's permission to do that. And when he did, the Jesuits take the vow of, you know, poverty, obedience, and chastity like all the rest of them do. But the Jesuits take an additional vow of absolute obedience to the Pope. And for the longest time, the head of the Jesuit order was always the confessor of the Pope, largely because of that that vow. So he says, to sum up, the three best and surest marks of lawful inspiration are perseverance, in contrast to inconstancy and levity, peace and gentleness of heart, in contrast to disquiet and solicitude, and humble obedience, in contrast to obstinacy and extravagance. So those kind of things that are give you peace of heart are the things you look for there. Anybody have any thoughts on all this stuff?
Well, what about Father Mark, the Jesuit? Now, I know someone right now who just read his book, and he thinks he's great because he's bringing the church up to date.
Yeah.
And then what about the bishops that don't agree with each other?
Yeah, they're
so
all...
You're supposed to follow your bishop.
Those are all really good examples, you know? And you know, when you see that kind of thing happening, and like what's going on in Germany, too, and there are others... that lack of obedience to authority and stuff like that. When you see those kind of things happen, it kind of brings back what St. John Chrysostom said way back in the 300 or 400s, I think. And he said the road to hell is paved with the skulls of priests and bishops. You know, because one of the things that the devil always does is try to create division everywhere he is. And so when you fall into that trap, when you fall into the division trap, you're just setting yourself up to have your skull on that road. You know, it's that idea of humility and obedience tied together is really, really important. And all the great people like Abraham and the rest of them, you always see those two characteristics together. You know, obedience and humility, they go hand in hand all the time. But yeah, you're right, these kind of things. It was there was a movement called the Shepherds of Christ. And it was kind of popular for a while. And there was a Jesuit priest that was their spiritual director. And then he was ordered by his superiors to stop his involvement with that and go do something else. And he refused. He was very disobedient to his superiors. And it kept on. And the whole movement kind of went haywire. You know, he was their spiritual guide, and he was being disobedient to his superiors, and the whole thing kind of went by the wayside.
So maybe that'll happen to Father Martin, too.
I imagine it will.
Right now.
I mean, it's Jesus is in charge. It's his church. It's his mystical body. You know, he promised that he would not let the gate of hell prevail, and that he never said, it's no longer my church. When Paul was prosecuting the church, he said, why are you persecuting me? So he identifies personally with the church. And so we have to trust Jesus. You remember in St. Faustina's diary, he kept saying how he gets upset when we don't trust him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is part of that. We got to trust him. Because, I mean, do any of us think we can do what he can do? I mean, he's God, right? I mean, none of us could possibly have the power and the knowledge and understanding to do what he can do to help the church.
Well, I think it also goes to the extent that people are willing to submit to divine will, right?
Like, yeah.
Everything in God's world is ordered. If you don't understand your place in the scheme of things, you tend to put yourself first. It's human nature.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not about what the individual wants. It's about what should be happening. And he gave a great example right after the quote you just gave about how, you know, flowers turn, certain yellow flowers turn to the sun, but the sunflower turns everything to the sun. So, or you can be that one flower that just turned, I mean, that one plant that just turns the flower to the sun and accept what you want to accept from the sun, or you're going to turn your entire plant, flower, leaf, stem, everything to the sun.
Yeah.
And that's what he really is asking.
Yep.
How far are you willing to go? How far are you willing to submit and accept his will?
Yeah.
You know, I always wondered, if the church goes off the rails, are we supposed to follow that or do what we know is right?
Like Father Martin.
Hmm?
Like Father Martin.
Well, Father Martin is not the authority of the church.
No, he's
just
not,
a priest, okay?
But they're treating him as though he's an authority.
Some people are, yeah. Some people are. But, you know, he's part of that whole community that's trying to foster immorality in our children and in our church.
But he does have authority as a priest.
Yeah.
And
he's got
he is definitely, well, I shouldn't say definitely.
Right, he does.
Appears to be misusing it.
Yeah.
To a lot of people's detriment.
That's true.
Well, he did, I saw a headline that he met with Pope Francis within
sometimes.
The last week.
I know, that's what they said.
Yeah. Well, look, go back in church history, okay? There was a period of time when we had, I think it was a total of either 6 or 7 antipopes.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what was an antipope? Did we ever have an antipope but not a pope? No, we always had a properly elected pope, and then we had an antipope.
Yeah.
And so, again, you saw the work of Satan trying to divide the church. Okay, but they always resolved it because we always had a lawfully elected pope.
And even the bad popes never taught
error.
Things that error, yes.
In faith and morals, right. I mean, we had some really bad popes.
We did.
You know, we had one guy that had a mistress and he was having all these kids. Every time he'd have a child, he'd ring the bells in the church and all that kind of stuff, you know.
I mean, it was awful.
But he never taught error in matters of faith and morals.
Yeah.
And we have to trust that. You know, we can't control it, but we have to trust it. We have to trust that God is in charge and that he's going to take care of this.
And the church will always teach his will.
Yeah. The church is never going to, he's never going to let a pope teach error in matters of faith and morals.
Mm.
And we have to trust that. That's just the way it is, you know. We're going to see popes teach a lot of crazy stuff, maybe, but it's not going to be in matters of faith and morals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, Francis is big on this climate change stuff.
Yeah.
Well, who knows, you know, why is he worried about that? Who does he think is in charge of the climate? It's not us. It's God. It's God's earth, you know, God's universe. I mean, there's nothing he can do to change the climate. It's been changing for centuries, you know. It goes up, it goes down, it gets cool, then it gets warm. When I was a kid growing up, I remember they had a cold spell. I was growing up in New Orleans, and we were going through this cold spell. And they had the headlines on the newspaper written in icicles. Saying, oh, the new ice age is coming, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And we're going to all freeze to death. You know, New Orleans is going to be an iceberg and all this kind of stuff. And had that passed, you know. Then we had this crisis and that crisis. We were always going through some kind of crisis. And, you know, God's in charge. And let's see. Go back to Francis here. He says, I must warn you, Theotimus, against a troublesome temptation that sometimes comes to souls who have a great desire to follow in all things what best accords with God's will. So they're trying to do the right thing, but they can have a troublesome temptation. A troublesome temptation is going to be coming from Satan. On every occasion, the enemy puts them in doubt as to whether it is God's will for them to do one thing rather than another. And in this way, they waste a great deal of time. When busying and perplexing themselves to discover what is better, they needlessly lose opportunities to do many good deeds. He's talking here about somebody who gets an inspiration to do something, and then they think, well, maybe there's something better that I could do. So they go through this mental turmoil, thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't do this, because maybe there's something really much better that I could do. And then they find out that they don't do either one, because the little good that they could do, they don't do, because they miss the opportunity. And the great good that they thought about doing, they were unable to do. So they don't do anything good. And so he said, you got to watch those kind of things too. He says they waste a great deal of time. So the accomplishment of such deeds would be more to God's glory than this distinction between the good and the better with which they have amused themselves could ever be. So if you get inspired to do something good and you feel comfortable about that, go ahead and do it. Maybe you can do something better later on, and he'll inspire you to do that. You know, the gospel story about, I'll give you this little, if you do well in this little thing, then I'll give you more to do. Maybe it's be one of those kind of things, you know. You never can tell. In the bottom of page 65 there, he says, we do not have to weigh all kinds of little actions to learn if some have greater value than others. Frequently, there is even a certain superstition in wanting to make such an examination. To what purpose should we trouble ourselves as to whether it is better to hear Mass in one church rather than another, to spin rather than sow, or to give alms to a man rather than to a woman? So those are just kind of some silly examples of some of the consternations people go through. You don't worry about stuff like that. You know, if you get inspired to give alms to some guy, you give it to him. You feel a call to go to Mass at this church, you go to it. A Mass is a Mass. It doesn't matter which church you hear it in. See, it is not giving good service to a master to spend as much time thinking about what is to be done as in actually doing what is required. So don't get a lot of consternation over about what is to be done. Just do it. You know, if it's a good thing, do it. Then he talks about things like choice of vocation, plans for some affair of great importance, a work requiring a long time, or some very great expenditure of money, change of residence, choice of associates, and such similar things require that we think seriously as to what best accords with God's will. Those are examples of exactly what I was talking about earlier about why you would go through the spiritual exercises of the Second Ages, because these are important questions, you know. If you're going to have a great expenditure, you want to make sure that you're using your resources for the right thing and doing it for the right reason. And he says, St. Basil says, to do freely what seems good to us, so as not to weary our minds, waste our time, and put ourselves in danger of disquiet, scruples, and superstition. That is, when there is no great disproportion between one work and another, where we meet no important circumstances on one side rather than the other. You know, when one's as good as another, don't worry about which one to do. Do one, if you got time left over, do the other one. You know? The scruples thing is kind of funny. Several years ago, I found this thing called a scruple spoon. I don't know if you've ever seen one or not, but it's called a scruple spoon. And it's a funny spoon. It's long. It's got a curved top for your finger to hold. And the bowl of the spoon is a little tiny thing that only holds 2 drops. And back in the old days, when you read the missal, when you're preparing the chalice, this is put about 2 drops of water in with the wine. So some people got really scrupulous, and they were afraid to put 3 drops, you know. So they made these scruple spoons that only held 2 drops. So they would dip the thing into the cruet and put 2 drops of water in the chalice, right? And I thought that was really hysterical when I found that. So I got it. I think I found it on eBay or something. And so I had this thing in, and I just thought it was really funny. And then Father Fisher came to St. William as his first assignment there. And I found out that he was really interested in church history. And so I gave it to him as a little thing for him to play with, you know. But
because it is interesting when you watch them. Some of them are careful to put one drop in and some just pour it in.
Yeah.
It's, it depends on your personality.
Yep. Yeah. It's just, you know, people worry about those kind of things. And that's the kind of thing Francis is saying, don't worry about it. Don't put a lot of that stuff in your mind. You know, do what you think is right and just don't worry about it. He says, even in important matters, we must be very humble and not think of finding God's will by force of scrutiny and subtle discussion. You can't force yourself into God's will. You know, if he's going to give you the inspiration, that's what you need. You know, you're not going to find his inspiration through scrutiny and subtle discussion. After we have implored the light of the Holy Spirit, applied our thought to search for his good pleasure, taken counsel with our director, and perhaps with two or three other spiritual persons, we must come to a resolution and decision in the name of God. If you're not sure about something, you find somebody else who you think is a good spiritual person. You talk it over, and if you got a spiritual director, you talk to them about it, and then you go do what you got to do. Okay. After that, we must not call our choice in doubt, but devoutly, peacefully, and firmly keep and sustain it. You get out of your chair and you go do the work. Yeah. Although the difficulties, temptations, and different events that occur in the course of carrying out our plan may cause us some uncertainty as to whether we have chosen well, still we must remain firm and not consider all such things. Satan is going to try to interfere with you actually doing the good thing. So if you run into some troubles doing it sometimes, don't worry about it. Put it aside and just plow on and keep doing it. Once our resolution has been devoutly made, we must never doubt the holiness of its execution. If we do not fail, it cannot fail. To act otherwise is a mark of great self-love or of childishness, weakness, and folly of mind. That's the end of that chapter. The next one is chapter 4, Learning to Embrace Your Crosses. I think I'm going to stop here for the day because this is a really important chapter. He goes into a lot of things in here that we're going to have to spend some time talking about. He's talking about the crosses that come to us in our lives. And we all get crosses, you know, some more serious than others, and how to deal with them. And I think it'd be better to try to get some continuity in the discussion on that rather than start getting to a few pages now and they have to wait a week and go in again. Speaking of which, do you guys want to meet again next Monday after Thanksgiving?
Sure.
Okay, mm-hmm. I'll be here. You know. Okay, we'll do that. So we will start next Monday with Learning to Embrace Your Crosses on page 71. Anybody have any final thoughts on anything we covered today? Okay. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Have a great holiday. And have a lot of fun with your families. And we'll see you in a week.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Have a blessed week.
You too. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you.